identification. This is an interview with Humphrey McQueen for the ANU Oral History Project. It's the 21st of February 1994. This is Tape 1, Side A, and my name's Stephen Foster. Humphrey, would you tell us how you became associated with ANU?
Well, it began in the late 60s. I suppose the first contact, apart from just visiting the place, would have been probably early 69, when Bruce McFarlane and a couple of other people in the politics department at the Institute tried to get me a postgraduate scholarship to come there and do a doctorate, would have had to have been, wouldn't it? And that managed to get to the point of getting me flown up for an interview one day. Although even by then I think they knew that it wasn't going to happen, but it was a kind of concession to the you know, that block in the department that wanted to do something else. And that was early, I think that must have been early 69, after the first two articles were published in Labour History and Australian Quarterly. Couldn't have been before then. I mean, there wouldn't have been any basis for asking for a scholarship. And by that time, out of those articles, Henry Mayer had read them and wrote nice things about them in his column in The Australian in those days, and got in touch with me. And as Henry did for lots of people, sort of adopted me and decided that he needed to, you know, that I needed advancing. And that meant taking out of, in his view, I think, out of high school and into a tertiary institution, which he tried to do first of all by getting Hugo Wolfson to employ me as a tutor in the politics department at La Trobe, and I gave a seminar there, and that was all very polite and nothing came out of that. And then I got a message, and the details of this I'm sure will all be written down in the copies of the letters upstairs to and from Henry about all of this, from Manning, or from somebody at least, to apply for a job as a senior tutor at the ANU in history. Now, by that time, I had actually been teaching Australian history for almost 2 years at school level. So I'd had some grounding in the kind of, the survey course and teaching it to students. But it all seemed pretty improbable, particularly after the previous two, non-happenings. And then it even got more improbable as I started to have dealings with Manning himself, as it was a kind of, I've got a bucket full of beer, but there's a hole in the bucket. And this just went on with telegrams and messages and things back and forth. So from day to day, I really didn't know whether I'd got the job or whether I hadn't. It took a very long time for me to be clear as to what, whether he wanted me, what was happening. We met, he arranged to meet me in Melbourne one day, and we met in the city, at Melbourne University. I took some time off school and went in to meet him. And we walked from the university down to the city and had what I realised, of course, later was a typical Manning conversation, which touched not at all on what we had to deal with, but was full of anecdotes and wonders when he suddenly sort of disappeared. Said, oh, well, yes, I'm going to have to get on this train or taxi or whatever it was, and just sort of, wasn't there. Second later, so I was none the wiser again at the end of all of this, what was happening. What had happened, I discovered later, was that Henry had sat beside him at an academy dinner or something and had said, do you have any jobs or something? And Manning said, yes, there's a couple of tutorships coming up. And Henry said, well, you must give one to this person called Humphrey McQueen. And Manning said, is he a Catholic and a communist? And Henry said, yes. He said, oh, good, then we'll have him. And has he taught fourth form boys? This was Manning's other criteria. Could he control a class of fourth form boys? And as I had done all of these things, then I was clearly a highly suitable candidate, despite the fact that I had a 2B honours degree from Queensland in politics. And I'd published these articles by then, but this was as well. And, of course, there was the New Britannia, which was in train, and that Henry knew about. But there was no interview. There was no formal selection process. I mean, tutors in those days were, I think, in the gift of the head of department. I mean, it was, and it was a one-year appointment. So eventually this, you know, an official notice arrived after ringing Manning's house, for, you know, on getting telegrams to do all this. I mean, it was chaos in my life. So it meant that I was then leaving the school to come here. And so I then spent the summer vacation writing as much as I could of New Britannia each day and getting ready to pack up and to move up here. Which we did. We came up on the train, which was quite an experience. The train from Melbourne used to go to Goulburn, and you get detached and put onto the back of a rattler. And we got a sleeper. In those days, I was fearful of flying, but I was much more frightened in the sleeper. We actually got down and lay on the floor for fear of being literally being thrown out of the sleeper as it rattled its way from Goulburn up that terrible line. And Bruce met us at the station and drove us around, showing us
Bruce
McFarlane, and showed us, you know, his view of Canberra, where things were, where the scandals had been. And then we had to turn up at housing to get the keys to a house in Garran that they were going to provide us with for virtually free rent. I mean, it was sort of, you know, $10 a week or something. I must say that moving from being a high school teacher, a fourth-year high school teacher, to a senior tutor was still an increase in salary. I mean, that school teachers were still so badly paid in Victoria that I, you know, my salary actually went up and my rent went down in coming here. Julie arrived without a job but found one fairly quickly at Darramalin and taught there for a year. And Canberra was expanding. I mean, it was at that point in which it had ceased to be the small bush town, and the arts complex in Civic had opened, and you know there was something. There were Sunday afternoon movies at the Canberra cinema, for example. But anyway, we got to housing, and we had a cat that we were bringing up with us, and we were told, of course, you weren't allowed to keep animals in those places. But there was a simple solution to this. When you went to the interview with the housing lady, you had to tell her, when she said, "Do you have any animals?" you'd say, "Yes, you had a cat." She would say, "Do you know you're not allowed to have a cat in those houses?" And you'd say, "Yes, but it's all right, we'll have it destroyed." Whereupon she would burst into tears and say, "No, it's perfectly all right, you can keep the cat." Well, this is what we did, and we were told that, yes, as long as it didn't destroy property and nobody else complained, there was no reason why we should have our cat destroyed. And
it
then,
was a very compassionate institution in those years.
Well, it operated in all these kinds of levels of people giving you guidance as to how to survive when you arrived. Indeed, I then, of course, met Shirley Bradley in the department. I don't know where Manning was. He's probably down the coast because it was the 20th of January. And for some reason, I had to be there on that day. I can't remember why it started then. What I then discovered, of course, was that, I think also fairly typical of Manning's administrative style, he'd appointed Les Louis to the same position. But as Les didn't arrive for another month, he ended up having to tutor in European history, whereas I'd arrived first and therefore got to tutor in Australian history. But I think he appointed Les on the same principle as he appointed me. Mm. And also the lame dog principle, you know, that you took in, you know, lame dogs and drunks and Catholics and, you know, and people, and sort of gave them a chance to, you know, to get over whatever it was that ailed them.
Mm. If Russell Ward were making such an appointment, he would have appointed a communist and a nun.
And a nun. And
every so often, I suppose, they turned out to be one and the same. So it was all mucked up. But Manning had no difficulty in appointing two people who leant to the left at the same time. Do you think that he was trying to get a balance in the department, that your appointment owed something to a wish to have somebody who leant far to the left to counter weigh?
I don't think he knew how far I leant to the left at all then, at all. I don't think. I mean, in a sense, I don't think. I think. I mean, I don't know why it happened. I literally don't know why. I mean, Henry told him, you know, that it was, you know, that it was a good, an important thing to do. one of those necessary things. And I always thought that it was a bit of Manning remembering, you know, his own days at Melbourne where he, you know, felt he'd been badly done by and that people needed to be rescued and given that sort of chance to do something. And the fact that I was writing a book, I think, impressed him. In fact, I know it did by the end of the year because the story has some ups and downs before we get to the end of the first year. I suppose our early feelings of the place was, I mean, I'd been at Queensland Uni and had known staff there through political contacts like Bruce and Helen Hughes and George and Ingrid Palmer and people like that who I got to know, but through because we were all politically active independently of the university. But otherwise you wouldn't have ever got to meet a staff member. And I mean, I'd really had very little experience of university life before I came here. I mean, I'd never been part of a university community in that sense. I mean, partly because I'd never done any postgraduate work in a university where you probably do get to, you know, have some closer or social contact with staff. So coming to a university was, you know, I didn't know what they were supposed to be like because, I mean, my own experience was of Queensland in the early 60s before it was a university. It was still a great sort of teachers' college, technical institution. I mean, when I went to Queensland Uni, the refectory was an old army hut. And there was no uni life that you could, you know, really talk about. I mean, by the time I left, they'd opened the Students' Union, the new building and things, but, you know, I mean, it wasn't. So, I mean, my expectations, I mean, I had nothing to judge it against, really. I mean, I wasn't judging it against Melbourne or Oxford or anywhere else. I mean, it just seemed to me that there was this place here and had a good library and it was close to this place, which, you know, before I got here, by the time term started, I'd actually finished writing in New Britannia and sent that off to Henry to read amongst other people. And he, again, was very enthusiastic. But what I felt, I suppose, most about the university was what Judy expressed, because she'd been at Monash just before and she got to know a couple of staff members there because she was active in the youth campaign against conscription. But she'd said if it hadn't been for that, she never would have spoken to a staff member while she was there. But here she felt that the whole place was a kindergarten, like a preschool centre for both staff and students. That everybody, I mean, she used to say, you know, I mean, if you had an abortion, you got 10 points and, you know, towards your final mark, and, you know, that there was this kind of, you know, that the whole sort of social dispensation and was that, you know, there was... And the sense that I got very early on that people would say to me as I walked in the corridor, in the way that when you're in hospital, the matron comes around, you know, when she thinks you're dying and says, "And how are you today?" with that sort of undertow in the voice, as if they were always expecting you to go mad and run away, which of course had happened quite a lot in the past. And there was always that sense of, you know, this question had this meaning underneath it. Now, for me, of course, I had no intention of doing any such thing. I was having a wonderful time because I could work here all the time and I could read and, you know, it was, you know, wasn't any problem at all. To me, I suppose the only time we got a bit funny like that was with a party at Manning's where we met the Fairburns, who were having one of their public domestics, but doing it all very sedately. And I suspect that night, if there'd been a midnight flight out, we might have got on it. But that was the closest we ever got to that sense of, you know, you can't possibly bear to live in Canberra. Although that was still a widespread feeling amongst, you know, that was left over, I think, from an earlier period in the place, of not just the ANU, but the whole town, that people couldn't bear to stay here and they'd run away. Mm. But that sense that there was cotton wool put between you a great deal to make sure that didn't happen to you.
And was that exhibited by the academics and the administrators?
Well, certainly it was most expressed and most practically expressed by Shirley Bradley. Sort of most sensibly, you know, understood in terms about it. The others, I think, tried to make it, you know, the other people in the department just made you feel, you know, made me feel welcome in that sense. And, you know, and when Judy would come in after school to meet me, because we'd sometimes eat there, right at 5 o'clock tute or something, we'd eat afterwards and then go home on the bus or something to Garran. I mean, Garran was an interesting phenomenon in itself because we got to know the local doctor. He became our doctor. We lived on the end and we didn't have children, so we were sort of on those sort of bits sticking out the side. He said that it was a gold mine for an epidemiologist. that all the children would get an infection and they simply would pass it around to each other, and that if he'd had time to actually plot this, he could have published endless papers in epidemiology in the place. And I suspect that was possibly also happening. Once you got closer into the middle of the ghetto, it was probably like that about matrimonial relations and all kinds of things, that there was, you know, a kind of, you know, core of activities going on of which we were no part, because we weren't involved in childminding systems and all the things that other people were, you know, were sort of, you know, might have been attached to. Teaching started, and I was, as I said about Paul, Les arrived to discover that he was having to teach European history. But I think grateful to have the job nonetheless, although I think a bit upset at the first, and then, of course, went on at the end of that year. I think Manning felt bad about it and got him the job as senior lecturer out at the CAE. But so he stayed the first year. I began to tutor for Eric Fry in the survey history course. And Manning had just introduced the start of the Australian history major, which he'd battled to get through. Now, this is when I first misbehaved, because I just come out of that bizarre system in Victoria where the Director General of Secondary Education there had gone to America and read an article by Alvin Toffler, which said, whatever you learn today will be no use to you tomorrow, so there's no point learning anything, so you might as well learn whatever you feel like. Which meant that the instructions that we all got in the high schools were to write our own syllabuses. You know, no longer was there to be a central syllabus or indeed a school syllabus, but every teacher had to write their own and then submit this. And there was this turmoil going on in the school system, as well as industrial action about wages and conditions that I was part of, partly because the president of the VSTA was on the staff, one of the senior masters at the school where I taught. So I'd come from a school system in which the staff meetings were very much concerned with developing syllabuses and curricula. This was considered quite perfectly normal, that the headmaster was not to intervene, that he was to be there for guidance, but not, you know, I mean, it was, you know, that had been my experience in the preceding 4 years of teaching. So when this discussion opened up here about running Australian History major, I just carried forward this assumptions that I had acquired in the preceding 4 years. This was a real discussion in which you argued about the educational values of what you were going to do, how you were going to do it, what different things would be available in each of these years, why were you going to do this bit of Australian history as one of the second or third year subjects rather than another bit, all of those sorts of things. Well, of course, this was not what was supposed to happen at all. Manning had decided he was going to have one of his one of the things he was going to bequeath to the ANU was an Australian history major, that Australian history was going to be taken seriously. He'd taught the survey course, well, you know, on and off for many years. Now he was going to teach whichever volume he was writing as the second year course. And eventually the following year, or a year later, the third year course was going to come in. I think in the second year I would have been there, which would have been 71, the second year course would have come in, and 72, the third year course would have come in. So this was, but they were still arguing about this. Now, some, of course, people knew about this because they'd been there beforehand and they knew Manning. But I knew none of this, and so we had a staff meeting in which I just behaved as I would have done, you know, at the school meeting, and, you know, disagreed with Manning, wanted to know why we were doing things, what different educational principles were going to be involved in in the third year course. I mean, where you covered the same period in the second and third year courses as you did in the survey course, what methodological differences were there going to be that was going to make this educationally, you know, valuable to do and things? Well, I don't think I realised in the meeting what was happening. But eventually Manning quite obviously got annoyed and closed the discussion by saying there comes a time when one must distinguish between the general will and the popular will. I thought, oh, well, okay. And Hector Kinloch took me aside afterwards and said, you know, after the, as we're going into the meeting, he said, what you've got to understand is that you know, you're not allowed to smell God's armpits. Well, all of this came as a great, you know, surprise to me that any of this was supposed to be happening, or indeed what battles Manning had had in order to keep Australian studies going, or, you know, I mean, that it wasn't, you know, a one-sided problem. But you know. So I hardly saw anything of Manning through all of that. He knew, because that year I gave a paper on Henry Lawson, which is the chapter in the New Britannia, at the Socialist Scholars Conference, and he got to know what was in that and didn't like it at all. Wasn't what he wanted to hear about Lawson. I mean, not only was it politically not what he wanted to hear, but it was also not the kind of thing he wanted, was interested in, because it didn't talk about Lawson's soul or his drunkenness, or, you know, didn't talk about the Manning in Lawson or the Lawson in Manning. I mean, it wasn't, so it didn't please him in any of these ways. And I also gave a paper, a seminar in the school, that I'd written, I'd been asked to write about taking a strong stand in history for a book of essays that someone was publishing. And I gave that. And without knowing what I'd done, of course, I said some unkind things about Sir Keith Hancock's historiography, which provoked Manning into leaving the seminar, getting up and going, which he often did. But I mean, it was, you know, I mean, I hadn't realised, I was told afterwards that, you know, that this was, you know, that he was, that Manning's friends were being attacked.
This was in the middle of the seminar.
Mm.
Before you'd finished talking.
Oh, no, I can't answer that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, but it was quite noticeable. Because he certainly always stayed till the end of people's talks. And if he'd left, for me to remember, and for people to explain to me why he'd done it, it was the, you know, that I think he was worried that Hancock at that time was sick or something as well. And was, you know, upset. But it was this. So anyway, Manning, as far as I was concerned, none of this was actually happening. But as far as Manning was concerned, he and I were not getting on at all. There was no sort of student activity around the place at the time. I mean, it was all directed against the war in Vietnam, so he was quite happy about all whatever I might have been doing as a political activist. He wasn't worried about that because it wasn't departmental, it wasn't administrative. That, in fact, came here very late. Doesn't arrive till 74, really, before that becomes a kind of front issue. And then somewhere in third term, John Hooker at Penguin asked me if I could get Manning to write a preface to A New Britannia, which I thought seemed to be, you know, sort of thing I could do. So I said yes, and he said yes, well, show me the manuscript. So I showed it to him. And he wrote a preface, which he got Shirley Bradley to give me, which Shirley was embarrassed about when she gave it to me. And I thought, oh, well, so I sent it off to Penguins. They said, look, we can't use this. I mean, there's a copy of it up in the papers up there somewhere. And it says that, you know, that the book's a bulldozer which knocks everything down, and, you know. I mean, it really was a very strong condemnation of the book. I mean, if you knew how Manning wrote, I mean, you knew what this was saying. So Penguin were then stuck with the problem. I mean, how do they get out of accepting Manning's preface? And Shirley came up with the solution, because I spoke to her about it. She said, look, tell him it's too short. Tell him he needs to write a longer one. They've left two pages in the book, and he'll write. So, and I'll get him, I'll talk to him. So she talked to him, and he by then, of course, had also had to change his mind a bit, because I had actually written a book. And as you know, he always said about those people who would have written a great book if only they had written a book. So in a sense, I had fulfilled one of the things that he wanted from people. That is, that I did actually produce things. And that, by that stage, he'd said to me that he wasn't sure that I would get reappointed the following year, earlier than then. And he and Eric were fighting, and had fought before I got there. I don't know about what. I never found out. but they'd had a battle over something. I mean, a sort of administrative thing in the department, or yes, but I never found out from either of them what the substance of it had been. Perhaps it was Manning's going around appointing people he bumped to in airports and things, to lectureships in the department and things. I mean, it may have been that Eric had decided you needed a bit more regularity and consultation into how the department was actually going to, you know, when these people arrived and suddenly had to teach subjects, was there any student demand for them, and, you know, what should be being done. But anyway, that's was there, and so Eric was sort of saying, and Don was also saying, this is ridiculous, you know, of course Humphrey has to be reappointed, you know. And Manning was going on leave in 71, and Don, very cunningly, Manning by the end of 70 had been in the department for 21 years in October, and there was to be a surprise party for Manning in the office, and that was the time in which they arranged for him to come, and Manning told him that John M. Ward wanted to see him, and so he had to turn up at 4:30 or something to see Ward. When he got there was this party. What Don had done, and I'd realised by then what was in fact happening, Don had actually got me to make the presentation and to make the speech,
the peacemaker,
which I did by saying what in fact was true, that when I'd left Glen Waverley High School, the senior master in who was in charge of mathematics came up to me and said how lucky I was that I was going to teach in the same department as Manning Clark, because he'd been a student at Melbourne in Manning's last year there, and they would have missed out on having Manning as their history teacher, and they all petitioned, the second years, whatever they were, all petitioned to be allowed to enrol a year early so they could have Manning teach them in his last year at Melbourne. So I was able to repeat this story. And Manning, in the meantime, however, had done something he hadn't done before he appointed me, which was to pay some attention to how I taught, and he came and inspected me. He told me he was going to come and sit in on a tutorial to see how they were going. Although Eric was taking the course, he gave a couple of guest lectures. But he came and sat in on a tutorial one afternoon. And he gave me plenty of warning, and, you know, and I told the students the week before that he was coming, and that, you know, I was being inspected, not them, and they had to talk and be prepared to talk. And that was quite an eventful afternoon. He arrived. It was a good tutorial group. It was the one before the 4:00 lecture, so there were a lot of part-time students, a lot of sort of young public servants and people who did work and have things to say. So the tutor, and it was about the Country Party and the RSL. Two things happened during the course of the tutor, which I think, knowing Manning, are significant in helping to form his final judgment as to whether I should be allowed to stay or go. One of these was that in the midst of it, my phone rang, and a friend of mine had rung to say that a mutual friend, well, the person ringing was actually only then an acquaintance, ringing to say that a mutual friend had committed suicide. And I had to tell him, well, look, I can't talk to you now. Can you ring me back after 6:00? You know, can we meet after 6:00 and we can talk then? But it took a little while to get him off the phone, as I couldn't actually... I mean, I was thinking, do I say this out loud into the classroom as to what the conversation's about, or do I, you know... So that was all a bit strange. Manning, of course, wasn't going to stay till the end of the tutor, because he then would have had to spoken to the students, and he's far too shy to do that. So he had to make some excuse to leave at about 4:10 rather than 4:05. But as he went, he got up and said, just before you go, I want to leave you with one question. Why is it, do you think, that the RSL and the Country Party want to... I mean, it was something like hang murderers and flog incarcerate homosexuals. And at this, he shut the door and ran down the corridor. I then saw him after class. There would have been the lecture, and then another troop from 5:00 to 6:00. And I was going across to meet the person who'd phoned, and I bumped into Manning. And I just said I thought I should explain to him a little bit about, why I took so long on the phone, because I wouldn't normally have, I'd have sort of put them off more quickly in the middle of a tutorial. And so without really, because I didn't know Manning at all or very well, I mean, none of this, you know, it was all learning experience for me. I said to him, the friend of mine rung to say that, that a friend of mine had been at uni with had committed suicide. Well, of course, it was like having an abortion. I was 10 points in front straight away. I mean, this was just the kind of experience that Manning expected and wanted people to have, in a sense, so that you could, you could talk about the things that really mattered.
Mm.
But anyway, I survived this inspection. I mean, I must say that at school by that time, the VSTA had refused to allow us to have inspectors in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
But that rule didn't apply at the ANU.
Mm-hmm.
And Manning was going away and Don was taking over as head of department. And so in all of that, Don just said, well, yes, Humphrey's going to tutor next year. And Manning then was happy to allow this to happen.
Was the term God Professor in current use?
I think it probably was, yes. I think it had been in use from in the 60s. But see, I mean, in Manning's case, he was a God Professor, but in a different sense of being God. I mean, Manning wasn't the authoritarian God Professor. He didn't lock the cupboard to the library when he went on long service leave and, not let anybody in for 6 months while he was away. I mean, it wasn't that sort of madness. It was more the sort of, God the Holy Spirit